What's the most important position in the NFL? Hands down, it's the designated driver. The guy who makes the winning drive home from the stadium safe and sound. The guy all the other guys depend on to stay sober. The guy who might be a guy, might be a gal, but is always a winner. Sign up to be that guy at the designated driver booth in the stadium. A message from your fans at MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. Visit us at mad.org.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
The performing arts are an important facet of life. There is no substitute for the relationship between audience and performer. Your contributions to the Henry Ford Community College Theater Program enable students and faculty to continue promoting HFCC's artistic standards. By becoming a member of the Friends of HFCC Theater, you are allowing the theater program to prosper through establishing a scholarship fund, improving costume and scene shop facilities, and enabling the continuation of musical theater productions. For more information on becoming a friend of HFCC Theater, call 313-845-6478.
Robots the size of blood cells, Earth-like planets outside the solar system.
Science fiction?
No, science faction. Join us, Seth Shostak and
Molly Bentley and
WHFR, each Tuesday at noon for Big Picture Science.
Big Picture Science steps back to get the wide-angle view on science and technology from where they've been to where they're headed.
So think big. Big Picture Science. You'll find it here on WHFR.FM every Tuesday at noon.
We're making waves on WHFR 89.3.
Thank you for listening to Philosophy Talk's free weekly download.
You can do your part for intelligent, reflective media by making a tax-deductible contribution to Philosophy Talk.
We really do rely on your support. Any contribution, big or small, will help us stay on the air and online.
And donating is very simple. Just visit our website at philosophytalk.org and click the donate link.
Thank you for supporting Philosophy Talk, and
thank you for thinking. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our program comes to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
We continue conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus. That's where Ken and I are professors of philosophy.
Today, it's a special edition of Philosophy Talk, the examined year 2012.
Socrates said that the unexamined life is not worth living, which means any year worth living through must be worth examining, and examining through the lens of philosophy.
Now, a very big event of 2012, at least here in the U.S., was our presidential election. From a philosophical perspective, it was an utterly fascinating campaign because it raised important questions about the role of truth in our political discourse.
We'll discuss the year in truth in American politics with Jason Stanley from Rutgers University later in the program. 2012 was also a year in which we once again inched closer to making science fiction become science reality.
Scientists finally completed the sequencing of the entire human genome, but new advances in stem cell research herald an age that will give us unparalleled power over the entire biosphere. Will we have the wisdom to use that power well?
We'll work through these issues with Hank Greeley, director of the Stanford Center for Law and the Biosciences.
2012 also marks the 100th anniversary of the founding father of computer science and artificial intelligence, the one and only Alan Turing.
We'll take the opportunity of Turing's centennial both to look back and to look forward at what Turing hath wrought with Barbara Gross from the Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences.
To get us started on the examined year, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Caitlin Esch, to find out more about the remarkable life of Alan Turing. She files this report.
Alan Turing is not exactly a household name.
One of the things that drew me to this story is that most people have never heard of him, and he really is someone that everyone should know about.
Patrick Salmon is the creator and executive producer of Codebreaker, a documentary film with dramatic recreations of Turing's life. Turing was born in London in 1912. During World War II, he was recruited to crack German codes at a country estate called Bletchley Park. Turing actually broke the German naval Enigma code, secret messages sent to U-boats in the Atlantic. Here's a scene from Codebreaker.
The Germans believed that this machine was completely unbreakable. Turing sat down with an Enigma machine, and he looked at it, and he thought, I can break that.
Historians say that the successful code-breaking effort shortened the war by as much as 2 years and saved millions of lives.
Turing's work during the war was top secret. After the war, he helped create the first computer. Here's a scene from an interview with Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak.
When you look back in something like computers, there's often a seed that everything came from. Alan Turing was sort of at the top of everything that ever developed, all the future research that was done by people building real equipment that can clink, 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 compute.
Turing was a genius, and he was strange.
He dressed very oddly and quite shabby in many cases. At Bletchley Park, he was known to wear pajamas under his jacket. He would wear a gas mask to work because he suffered from hay fever. During the war, he was concerned about a German invasion of England, and so he bought some silver, and he buried the silver in case there was an invasion, but he ended up forgetting where he had buried it, so it's actually never been found.
Turing was also gay. Salmon says Turing didn't hide his sexuality, which was uncommon for the time. Here's Joan Clark, the woman Turing nearly married.
He told me that he had this homosexual tendency. Naturally, that worried me a bit because I did know that was something which was almost certainly permanent. But we carried on.
In late 1951, Alan Turing meets a young man in Manchester named Arnold Murray. Eventually, Turing invites Murray over to his house for dinner, and they end up having a brief relationship that lasts 6 weeks or 2 months, very brief.
Patrick Salmon says Arnold Murray was a 19-year-old from the wrong side of the tracks. He stole money from Turing, and then Turing came home one day to find his house had been burgled, apparently by one of Murray's friends.
When he finds out who's responsible for the burglary, he calls the police.
Here's a dramatized account of what followed. It's a conversation between Turing and his psychiatrist, Dr. Franz Greenbaum.
So what did you say to the police?
I told them everything. I told them I'd been having an affair with Arnold Murray and that he'd given my address to a young man who was known to burgle men he'd met for sex.
Turing then faces criminal charges for gross indecency, and he pleads guilty. Here's Salmon.
As part of the guilty plea, the judge gives him a choice. Turing can either go to prison for a year or he can get put on probation, but as a condition of the probation, he has to take hormone therapy.
He chooses hormone therapy, chemical castration. After all this, Turing finds he's being followed by the police. Here's a scene from an interview with Turing's biographer, David Levitt.
We have to remember 1952 was the absolute height of Cold War paranoia, during which the idea of the homosexual traitor was taking hold in the popular imagination.
Homosexuals must not be handling top secret material. The pervert is easy prey to the blackmailer.
Turing could no longer live an ordinary life, and in 1954, at the age of 41, he committed suicide by poisoning himself with cyanide. And so England lost one of the greatest minds of the 20th century, the father of artificial intelligence and early computers, the eccentric codebreaker Alan Turing. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Caitlin Esch.
I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
Today, it's the examined year, 2012, the year in philosophy. With us is Barbara Gross. She's a professor at the Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Sciences, and she's got some thoughts about the centennial of Alan Turing. Barbara, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
It's great to be with you, John and Ken. Thank you for inviting me.
Barbara, give us a brief overview of the state of computer science and artificial intelligence, especially in relation to the expectations and hopes that Alan Turing had in the year 2012.
If Turing were to drop into this world, he would be tremendously excited by what he saw. just look around in the world at how many systems are out there that people use every day that have inside them some piece of artificial intelligence. So Google's making driverless cars. They're now legal in California. Apple made Siri a year ago, and there's a race on for people to make better Siris. Microsoft and Google are translating in real time and trying to translate in real time into your own voice. So each of these successes out in the world has been built on decades, really, of research in all the different areas of artificial intelligence.
Sounds like we're in kind of a golden age of artificial intelligence. Would you characterize it that way?
I think we are. That it's really, it's come of age. It's producing techniques that can actually get out there in the world, and it's continuing to produce a rich array of research problems.
So let me sound a not exactly a sour note, but a little less enthusiasm. And I'll take a historical angle. So let's go back to the 50s when Turing wrote. There was also another very influential paper by a guy named Bar Hillel, if I remember correctly, in which he said, take a simple sentence like, put the baby in the pen. Any human being would understand that right away. They wouldn't have to worry about whether you meant put the baby in the fountain pen or the penitentiary or the pig pen. They would know you meant put the baby in the playpen. But a computer, how would it ever figure that out? It's hopeless. Okay, now jump ahead to 1983 when you and I worked together out here in Silicon Valley, me at Stanford and you at SRI. There we had a vision. We can teach computers the common sense and the knowledge they need to reason like humans. We can have computers that speak language because they would have common sense. They would follow rules. In your case, they would understand the sequence of actions necessary for planned activities. Now, that hasn't happened. We probably do have computers now that wouldn't have any problem with put the baby in the pen, but the reason is that they would search a corpus of about 20 zillion utterances, and they would look for, statistically, for matches between baby and playpen, baby fountain pen, and baby and penitentiary, and they would come to the right answer, but for completely the wrong reason. So are we really any closer to what Turing had in mind?
Well, the answer is both yes and no, John. So you're right. They wouldn't have any trouble with the baby in the pen because they would have run statistical algorithms over very, very large bodies of data, and they would have figured out what the best relationship is. I mean, interestingly, the question that Turing avoided, which is, could machines think? He wanted to avoid that question because he didn't want to define machines and he didn't want to define thinking.
Right.
And yet, here we are, wondering what thinking is and whether machines are doing them. By the way, it's worth noting, perhaps, that Turing took thinking and being intelligent to be the same thing.
Right, and he actually came up with a test, a famous test. Without having to define thinking exactly, he came up with a test that he thought would sort of conclusively establish whether a thing was thinking or not. Can you describe that test for us?
Yeah, it was a test which he called the imitation game. And here's the basic question he was asking. Could you construct a computer system that would be able to carry on a dialogue with a person that could range over any subject matter at all, carry on that dialogue so well it would be indistinguishable from a person? And the test that he set up was to put a person in one room, a computer system in another room, and then a person who would do the testing in a third room. So nothing about the physical appearance of the person or the computer would matter. And the testing person could ask questions of either one, and they would answer, and after a while would indicate which one was a person and which one was a computer system.
You think Siri, you know, the assistant on the iPhone, you think Siri can pass the Turing test?
Well, let me ask you a little bit more pointed question. If you wanted to fool Siri, what kind of questions would you ask her?
So I'll give you an example. If I ask what's the nearest gas station, I get a response from Siri that's something like,
I found 15 gas stations fairly close to you.
Then when I say which ones are open,
let me think.
Siri can't do it.
Would you like me to search the web for which ones are open?
Even if I ask what's the nearest open gas station, which in a sense is what I mean when I say what's the nearest gas station, obviously I don't want a gas station that's closed. If I ask what's the nearest open gas station, I get a response.
I can't look specifically for opening and closing times. My apologies.
So, no, Siri doesn't pass the Turing test. But if your goal is to have a personal assistant, then as so long as you only ask it to do what it's been designed to do, you're in good shape.
So when you said it's a golden age of artificial intelligence, I think you really mean it's a golden age of a certain kind of artificial intelligence. When I was a young man getting interested in cognitive science, we thought that artificial intelligence was going to unlock the secrets of how the human mind actually works, how human intelligence actually works. It sounds like you and John are saying that, well, there's a bunch of really cool technology out there that works with huge corpuses and huge statistical engines, but that's not really plausible that that's how human beings do these things. So as a model of human cognition, artificial intelligence, we shouldn't look to it anymore. But as a kind of engineering thing where it does enables us to do lots of cool things, it's a great age. I mean, would you agree with that assessment of the state of the thing or not?
Ken, what's true is the wonderful gadgets that are out there are not telling us how we think, but the research that sheds light on how we think is research that also supports the building of those systems. Or maybe the way to say it is that the research that has supported the building of those systems is also shedding light on how we think. In fact, I think that actually gets me back to something I thought was very important in Turing's paper in 1950, in which he introduced the idea of artificial intelligence and the question of whether machines could think. And he said in that, conjectures are of great importance since they suggest useful lines of research. He was a big advocate of research and of aiming for things that we didn't know how to do but could enlighten us as we tried to do them.
We've been talking about Alan Turing. He would be 100 years old, or he would have been 100 years old in 2012. That's kind of amazing that the father of computer science, the father of artificial intelligence, would only be 100 years old when that has become such a big part of everyone's life. We should probably also mention that Alan Turing, while he might be pleased at the advances in artificial intelligence and computer science, as Barbara mentions, would also be pleased, I think, at the acceptance of gay rights. He was a martyr to prejudice against gays in spite of his heroic and prize-winning efforts in World War II.
So, Barbara, thanks for joining us. It's been a fascinating conversation on the 100th anniversary of Alan Turing and his legacy. Really, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been a great pleasure to join both of you. Thank you.
Barbara Gross from Harvard University and her thoughts on Alan Turing.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're looking through a philosophical lens at the ideas and events that shaped the last 12 months. It's the examined year, 2012.
Coming up, the presidential election may be over, but the demise of truth may have only just begun.
It's the year in politics, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year, 2012. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're taking a philosophical look at some of the ideas and events of 2012. Ideas and events that challenged our assumptions and made us think about things in new ways.
I've always assumed that truth matters in politics, but in 2012, I really had to question that assumption.
Romney left Massachusetts $1 billion in debt.
For his first interview as president, Barack Obama chose Arab TV for an apology.
Start by listening.
What's worse, the media played along. They tended to present the untruths unchallenged as just one side of a two-sided story.
You know what? I just want to give it to you verbatim here. It says his remark was not intended to be a factual statement.
So let's talk more about the year in politics and the assault on truth with a philosopher who's been thinking pretty hard about such issues. That's Jason Stanley from Rutgers University. Jason, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you.
So, Jason, this year we had a political election, and you wrote some pieces that appeared in various places that suggest that Truth was even worse off this year than in past elections. Is that your view?
That's my view. My view is certainly that one side believed that Truth was no longer relevant to the assessment of a candidate.
Well, I did send an email to the Obama people saying I really thought the amount of time spent on Big Bird, did that show a lot of respect for the truth?
Well, there's politics as usual, and then there's focusing on what's distinct about various campaigns. I think the Romney-Ryan campaign, in contrast to, say, the McCain campaign, was quite explicit about inconsistency. They were quite explicit about being inconsistent. This is the point I made in my New York Times piece, Speech, Lies, and Apathy, the day after the Ryan speech at the Republican National Convention.
The planners in Washington still didn't have enough money. They needed more. They needed hundreds of billions more. So they just took it all away from Medicare. $716 billion funneled out of Medicare by President Obama.
Presumably the audience at the Republican National Convention was well aware that the things Ryan was accusing Obama of were things that he and Obama had in common. So I think the public was quite tolerant, or at least the expectation of the Romney-Ryan campaign was that the public would be quite tolerant of inconsistency and blatant disregard for the truth. I think there's been a change in the degree to which people trust mainstream media outlets and politicians, so much so that they don't expect politicians or the media to be delivering a fair assessment of what they know.
Well, somewhat oddly, the one show I trust the most is Jon Stewart, who's supposed to be a comedian. This does seem like a new development with this election. It was a little bit true maybe 4 years ago. But what does it say about our culture that the guy we have to rely on for the most fair and balanced truth-telling is our comedian?
That's a brilliant point, John. There's two ways of taking that point. On the one hand, you could say, well, maybe democracy does not require the sort of deliberative, open public space of the giving and taking of reasons that sounds like a seminar room. Maybe we can have a democracy where it's just sarcasm and mockery leading us to endorse one politician over the other.
That might be more fun.
Comedians do social commentary through comedy. That's how it's worked for thousands of years. I have not moved out of the comedian's box into the news box. The news box is moving towards me.
The alternative is maybe it's a sign, as John suggested, that it's no longer possible to honestly state your opinion in a public forum. The only way to convey a message is via these indirect means of sarcasm or mockery, or the speech act that I think is going on with MSNBC and Fox News, which I call in my work counterbalancing rather than assertion.
Counterbalancing, what is that? Tell me a little bit more about that.
So the idea is that some people in the press decided to promulgate a view that was common in theory circles in the 1990s, that everyone is speaking from an ideology. No one is just saying what they know. Everyone's speaking from an ideological perspective. Politics is everywhere. That became, I think, the dominant meme in the right-wing media specifically.
I think that they have a liberal agenda, and right. I think we tell the other side of the story.
My hypothesis is that instead of assertion, people saying things and trusting each other's word in the public sphere, what we have now is a speech act called counterbalancing, where everyone thinks that it's justified to stretch or exaggerate or flat out say false things in order to counterbalance the false things said on the other side.
But that sounds kind of like a postmodern leftist idea, not an idea of the right.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right, Ken. And it's a fascinating thing about what's happened in the last 20 years. Originally, it was the crazy humanists in the academy, the ones attacked by the right wing, who were saying truth doesn't matter, everyone's being ideological, science doesn't matter. And then later, it's climate scientists who are being attacked for not being objective, for really having an ideological agenda, for trying to get you to wear Birkenstocks. So it was this
left-wing postmodern idea that science isn't objective, everyone is trying to promote an ideological agenda. It's that view that you find being promoted in the media organs of the right, that there's no such thing as objectivity anymore, everyone's being ideological. That was a view attacked by Alan Bloom in The Closing of the American Mind from the right that's now been adopted by the right.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk, and we're talking to Jason Stanley from Rutgers University about the year in truth.
But I want to ask you something else about this, though. It's not actually crazy for Fox News or MSNBC to do what it does. Fox News is highly successful because I think they took the results of some cognitive science research and turned them into a business model that's highly successful. And that has to do with confirmation bias. People loathe, it turns out, evidence that disconfirms what they antecedently believe, and love evidence that supports what they antecedently believe, and seek out confirming evidence, and will attack the sources of potentially disconfirming evidence and try to negate their standing as evidence-bearing. And Fox, the people at Fox News, and I think the people at MSNBC, kind of belatedly, they caught on to this as this is a potential goldmine.
I think you're absolutely right about that, Ken, and I think the motive, profit motive has to be paid attention to. And, you know, there's a biography coming out of Roger Ailes soon. Maybe we'll see it there. But there's a little bit of unclarity in what you said when you talked about evidence. My hypothesis is that it's not evidence that's being provided by Fox News. The listeners of Fox News know that a lot of what's being said is false. They nevertheless like it because they feel like they're watching their team trying to score.
The American people didn't want to be told what to think about the information they were receiving. So we came up with We Report, You Decide, fair and balanced.
The viewers of Fox News, they don't think Fox News is fair and balanced. They think that something else is going on with this speech that's being made in that venue. They think it's required to counterbalance the statements made in the mainstream media. Now, that might be okay in a situation in which everyone is saying false things. But in fact, if the mainstream media isn't saying false things, if in fact, as people of my political stripe think that the mainstream media is in fact already tilted to the right, then counterbalancing is not going to result in any kind of approximation to the truth.
Well, my confirmation bias is basically involves watching MSNBC. But I draw a line between Rachel Maddow and Ed Schultz. I don't really enjoy watching Ed Schultz because I think his taking things out of context and bombast is just a little bit beyond the edge, whereas she's just pushing the limit.
The Republicans lie. I know what they want to do. They want to take down American workers. They want to outsource jobs. They want to see you dead.
And I think my friends on the right often make a similar distinction between, say, Bill Riley and Rush Limbaugh. So maybe there is a limit to confirmation bias. Maybe there's some degree to which it won't pay these news outlets to go in terms of what do you call balancing rather than asserting.
So, okay, we're philosophers, and we're taking a philosophical look at the year in politics. And this issue about the role of truth in political discourse, I think the difference between political discourse and, let's say, scientific discourse or philosophical discourse. Scientific discourse, we're all mutually aiming to get at the truth. In philosophical discourse, I like to believe that we're all mutually aiming to get at the truth, right? And so we're moved by, as a philosopher we all know, Robert Brandom sometimes puts it, we try to be moved by the force of the better reason. In politics, what you're trying to do, tell me if you disagree with this, what you're trying to do as a political campaigner is seize power through democratic means by whatever means you can get away with. It's not about inviting. Howard Dean said on MSNBC, and this I found this a revelation. He said, in politics, if you're explaining, you're losing. Right? Explain what you're going to do, he says, after you get elected. But don't explain as a way of getting elected. If you're explaining, you're losing. If you're explaining, I have this 3-point plan and here's how it works, blah, 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 you're losing. So that suggests that he thinks of and he's a guy I greatly respect. Politics is not a mutual search for the truth, but it's trying to mobilize your forces and, you know, seize the reins of state power.
I want to make a concession to you that that's part of politics, but note that you said that in democracy, you're attempting to seize power through democratic means. What does it mean to seize power through democratic means versus, say, other kinds of means? I think what we find in the political philosophy literature, both via figures like Habermas and figures like your colleague Josh Cohen, is through democratic means in part by use of reasons, where reasons are things that are subject to rational criticism, are not merely things that appeal to our desires and wants and wishes and irrational ideology. So I take seriously the through democratic means part of your comment. I mean, I think if we compare politics to advertising and we say, well, in advertising, of course, you're trying to sell your product through the means of the media and advertising. But still, there's laws on deceit in advertising.
Let me ask you, is America worse off in this respect than democratic nations around the world, do you think?
I think it certainly is. I think democratic nations around the world, citizens generally have more time away from work to reflect on politics in their country. I think they feel more involved in the political process, less estranged. The level of public discourse is higher. The insight into the policies is higher. I don't know if economists play the same role, obfuscatory role in public discourse as they do in the United States.
But there's more collective commitment to truth and rational deliberation in democracies around the world than in the United States, because that's the thing that we're also struck by, right, in this year in politics, the year 2012 in politics. At least one side, and arguably both, but at least one side seemed to have abandoned whole hog the commitment to, you know, shared weighing of reasons pro and con in a non-manipulative way.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think it's unsurprising that they did, given what the right-wing media has been saying for the last decade. Right-wing media has been saying no one is attempting to assert things, to say true things anymore. Everyone is being ideological. The right-wing media has been pushing that line that we're familiar with postmodernists from the 80s and 90s. And it's no surprise that then a politician out of that tradition is going to think, okay, everyone thinks everyone is saying false things, so truth doesn't matter anymore. I mean, it's not, this is distinctive, and you could easily see this being coming from any political angle. I mean, my concern is with trust and truth. My concern is with preserving the preconditions of a democratic society. It's not a concern with ideology. It just happens that in this particular election, one side seemed to be convinced that there was no price anymore for saying false things.
The truthiness is, anyone can read the news to you. I promise to feel the news at you.
Jason Stanley from Rutgers University on the Year in Politics and Truth. You're listening to a special edition of Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year 2012. I'm John Perry. Here with me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
The recent events in Newtown, Connecticut have brought the discussion of our gun laws back into the spotlight. Now, John, you were saying the other day you're actually thinking about weighing in on this issue from a philosophical perspective. Are there some philosophical implications of the Second Amendment in your eyes?
Well, I don't know about the Second Amendment, but I think we ought to take a look at what I call the metaphysics of guns. I think the way we think about guns is an example of thinking about something that's come to have a big symbolic role in our life and forgetting what it really is. What is a gun really? A gun is a way of making a hole in something some distance away quickly. That's what it is. Then there's all kinds of variations on that. You can make big holes, little holes, lots of holes like you do with a shotgun, a single hole like you do with a .22. You can make a number of holes in succession with your gun and the system that goes with it, or you can be limited to a few. That's what it is. That's the metaphysics of guns. Now, just compare that with other things that would be somewhat similar. Suppose instead of making a hole in something, you could cause cancer in something 100 yards away.
just by pulling a trigger. Suppose that was a new invention. What kind of laws would we make for a new invention that allowed someone to cause cancer in something else 100 yards away? Well, we'd probably ban it entirely. Well, what if it turned out to be a lot of fun to make cancer grow in a tree or on an animal? And some people cared a lot about that. Well, we might want to accommodate them. But we'd really be careful about it, because when you give someone the power to cause cancer in me from 100 yards away, from the deck of the apartment next door or down the street, that's really going to change my life. Now, we should approach guns the same way we would approach something new like that. We should forget about all the symbolism and the heroism and the fact that all of our military heroes use guns and that Wyatt Earp used guns, and just think about, what does this thing do and what do reasonable people do with something like that? I think that when the government wants to do something unreasonable, the Constitution usually doesn't stand in the way. It usually stands in the way when they want to do something reasonable.
Like limit the ownership of guns.
Exactly.
You're listening to Philosophy Talks Year in Review Special, the examined year 2012.
What were the big scientific and medical achievements of the past 12 months? What new techniques forced us to fundamentally shift the way we think about the world and our own role in it?
It's the year in genetics when Philosophy Talk continues.
It's the examined year 2012. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're taking a philosophical look at the past 12 months.
And now, it's the year in genetics.
Alive! It's alive! It's alive!
We're joined by Hank Greeley from the Stanford Law School, where he's director of the Center for Law and the Biosciences. Hank, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, Hank, you're a lawyer by trade, but you're really interested in bioscience. What are some of the highlights from the year 2012 in the biosciences?
Well, I think genetics, our understanding of DNA is really expanding enormously because the cost of sequencing DNA is getting lower and lower at a remarkable pace. The first human genome was sequenced less than 10 years ago, and that cost about $500 million, give or take a few hundred million. 3 years ago, Steve Quake at Stanford sequenced himself for $50,000. This year, you can buy your own sequence from several commercial companies for $5,000. The $1,000 genome and the $500 genome aren't very far away, and when the price gets down to several hundred dollars, I think it's likely to be irresistible. I suspect that within a decade or so, almost everybody with good health coverage is going to have had their entire genome sequenced, at least in the U.S.
What are the kinds of things I might find out about? Could I find out that I have a predisposition to Alzheimer's? And by the way, could I find out that I have a predisposition to Alzheimer's?
So the kinds of things you could find out certainly would include a high risk of Alzheimer's. About 2% of us have a very high risk of Alzheimer's genetically, 80% risk or more. And another 20% of us have double or triple the normal chance of getting Alzheimer's. And that's something that's pretty easy to test for. Now, the problem with Alzheimer's is there's not much you can do about it medically. But there are other conditions. For example, there's a colon cancer predisposition. If you've got a particular set of genetic mutations, your risks of getting colon cancer go way, way up. But colon cancer is something you don't have to die from. If you know you're at high risk, you get screened for colon cancer much more frequently, and you end up not dying from colon cancer. That's the best side. That's one where there's a high-risk condition that you can do something medically about. The downside, I think, is all of our genomes are going to have literally hundreds of thousands of sections that have never been seen before and that nobody knows what to do about. Nobody will understand it. We're going to be buried under great masses of confusing, unclear, and constantly changing information.
Well, I don't see why that's a downside. That means that's room for new thought and new experimentation and new science. But I want to ask you a different kind of question, Hank. Suppose I'm one of those people with bad stuff in my genes, I mean, there's a good use I can make of that. I can, you know, take preventative measures or corrective measures because I now have some new knowledge. But there's a bad use that other people can make of that. That people can say, I don't want to hire that guy. I don't want to admit that guy to my... I don't want to... And besides, if I'm going to insure that guy, it's going to cost that guy this much.
Isn't my insurance company going to pay for this and then, if there's bad news, cancel my insurance?
There are two pieces of good news. One is health insurance and employment discrimination based on genetic information are now illegal in the United States. The fact that it's illegal doesn't mean that it can't ever happen, but it greatly reduces the likelihood of it happening. And the second interesting piece of good news is even before it became illegal, there wasn't that much evidence that it was actually happening. Because for most of us, the risks of any one particular disease are swamped by the general risks of living, of getting hit by a bus, or getting a bad flu, you know, getting a bad infectious disease. So people have been concerned about genetic discrimination. I think it's fair to be a little bit worried about it, but not very much.
You sound like a Pollyanna, man. I mean, I know people who see dark future on the horizon, you know. Not only just the genetic information, the ability to manipulate your genes, to choose the gender, the level of intelligence of your offspring, to fine-tune everything. You know, is that day not on the horizon?
Right now, today, there are four companies in the United States that will sell prenatal genetic tests for a series of bad genetic conditions where you've got the wrong number of chromosomes. Down syndrome is the most well-known and the most common of these. Now, that's not new. We've been doing prenatal genetic testing for 30 years, but it's always required either amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling. You've had to do an invasive procedure with risks of miscarriage, with expense, with discomfort, to get that fetal DNA out of the uterus where it's nicely packed away. The big change now is because of the lowered cost of sequencing, it turns out you can find some of the fetus's DNA in the pregnant woman's bloodstream as early as the fifth week of pregnancy. Now, you don't need amniocentesis. You don't need an invasive and dangerous, expensive procedure. The first time you go in for prenatal care, when they're drawing blood for tests, they draw one more tube of blood, and that can be used to test for a bunch of genetic things. It can also be used to test for them at an early enough stage in the pregnancy that you don't look pregnant, no one necessarily knows you're pregnant, a termination, an abortion is a lot easier to do at 8 weeks than it is at 18 weeks. It's called non-invasive prenatal genetic testing, and I think it's going to sweep the country in the next few years.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're looking at the year in philosophical review, and we're talking to Hank Greeley about the year in genetics.
Is there anything that happened this year in the field of genetics that has the feel of more like a breakthrough, something we thought we might be able to do, and now it turns out, surprisingly, we can do it? Is there any sort of kind of more fundamental breakthrough happening at all?
So here's one it's not directly from genetics, but it's got genetic consequences. Making eggs and sperm from stem cells. It's not been done with humans yet, although people are working on it, but it has been done with mice, both this year for eggs, last year for sperm. A Japanese scientist named Saitou took mouse stem cells. First, he took them and turned them into sperm and used those sperm to do mousey in vitro fertilization and made healthy little mice. This year, he took those stem cells, turned them into eggs, did mouse in vitro fertilization, and turned those into healthy mice. Now, I don't know that this should have been shocking, but I don't know that anybody was paying very much attention to it. Because in the stem cell world, people have been excited about nerve cells or cells to make insulin in the pancreas. And nobody's, I think, really paid much attention to the possible implications of being able to make eggs and sperm.
It strikes me, tell me if I've got this right, could this make old-fashioned reproduction kind of like obsolete, except for the fun of it, you know?
This promises to relieve mankind or humankind from the scourge of sexual intercourse.
So I actually am writing a book on this, and the current working title is The End of Sex. But it's only the end of sex for conceiving babies. And I think the actual implementation of this is 20, 30 years off. I hope so anyway, because I think we need to be real careful about technological breakthroughs that we use to make children. We need to be really sure those are safe. But I think in 20 or 30 years, most people who have good health coverage anywhere in the world will conceive their babies not in bed or in the back seat of a car, but will conceive them through IVF using eggs made from stem cells to avoid egg harvest. You'll make, say, 100 embryos. And here's where the genetics comes in. Each one of those embryos you can then check at day 3 and get a whole genome sequence for it. And the parents-to-be can be told, okay, here are your 100 embryos, cleverly named 1 through 100. Number 12, he's going to be male, tall, very athletic, low disease risks for this, that, and the other thing. He's your Andrew Luck.
It sounds like it's pretty astounding.
I think so. I think it's going to change how we make babies. I think it's going to change our species in some good ways. So I think it will lead to far fewer people being born with really nasty genetic diseases. I think it will lead to fewer people being born with high genetic risks for diseases later in life, like Alzheimer's, or like some of the colon cancer or breast and ovarian cancer syndromes. But things that worry me, it may lead, at least for a while, to a lot more boys being born than girls. Now, I don't have any particular objection to boys versus girls, but the imbalance between the two, which we're already seeing through old-fashioned mechanisms in India, China, and other places, can lead to some real problems.
I would think one thing we might do with this technology is just eliminate boys altogether, at least for the occasional sperm donor. I mean, I think there's a lot of evidence that most human misery comes from males.
Well, it is true that something like 94% of violent crime is committed by males rather than females. I think it would be an interesting experiment that you couldn't get IRB approval for to have a wholly female society and see if women moved into that violent niche.
If you look at other domestic animals, where we really limit the number of males, you don't find your heifers kind of becoming violent because there's so few steers around, or I should say, you don't find your cows becoming violent because there's so few bulls around. So I don't think there's any reason to fear that, but this may be slightly unrealistic.
Yeah, although I'll tell you, this stem cell made eggs and sperm has a twist on it that I think is interesting. It should be possible to actually not just take skin cells from you and turn them into stem cells and then turn those into sperm, but we might be able to make eggs from your cells, or we might be able to make sperm from a woman's cells.
Oh my goodness.
Which could actually lead to the end of any need for men, but in the shorter term could lead to lots of gay and lesbian parents being able for the first time to have children that genetically are entirely their own.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. It's the examined year, 2012. We're talking about the year in genetics with Hank Greeley from Stanford University.
So we're worried about the future, but maybe in the future we can revive some of the past. What's this I hear about having woolly mammoths around again?
So this is a new, interesting idea, again, made possible by the advances in technology and the decreasing costs of technology. Let's say you've got an elephant and you've got its entire genetic sequence, which we do. And let's say you've got a piece of 20,000-year-old frozen mammoth. And from that frozen mammoth, you can get its gene sequence, which we've done. We know now, for example, that woolly mammoths are closer to Asian elephants than they are to African elephants. So now that you know that, you can take a cell line made from an Asian elephant and start making changes in its DNA. You can look at the two sequences to see where in their genes woolly mammoths are different from Asian elephants, and you can start modifying the Asian elephants to make their genes more like the genes of a woolly mammoth. And over time, you end up with something that looks an awful lot, both genetically and in the flesh, like a woolly mammoth, or like a passenger pigeon, or like a dodo, or like a saber-toothed cat.
What about dinosaurs? I'm a big, huge dinosaur fan. Can we get some dinosaurs back around here?
Yeah, I'm afraid dinosaurs are out of reach. What you really need in order to be able to do this is a good copy of the DNA of the extinct thing. And we know that we can get DNA back as far as about 100,000 years. But the people I talk to think the chances of ever finding good samples of DNA from 65 million years ago are just about zero. So I don't think we can get you Jurassic Park, but I think we can get you Pleistocene Park.
Oh, there you go. That's cool.
Well, you know, on this de-extinction stuff, I think there are a couple of extensions that are particularly interesting. One is there's an extinct Pleistocene mammal whose sequence we know really well, Homo Neanderthal. Should we try to bring back Neanderthals?
Wow. The person in me who says, let science go, says, heck yeah. The person in me that doubts the wisdom of human institutions says, not so fast. I mean, so I'm torn because I'd love to know. I mean, there are all these questions about whether Neanderthals, for example, had the capacity for language. How different really were they cognitively from us? And there are all these burning questions that, as a person who loves science and who has deep scientific curiosity, I would love to see answered. Moreover, the idea that we could revive extinct species, I don't think we should revive every extinct species because we'd screw up with the habitats. I mean, the woolly mammoth's habitat has been taken over, I assume, by the elephant, and we don't want to give them new competition. But, you know, we want the Earth. We want to preserve the biodiversity of the Earth, and we don't want habitats to keep shrinking and shrinking and shrinking until the world is nothing but, you know, bleared and smeared with trade and the man smell and all that sort of stuff. So I think that's a good thing, but it's really also a potentially troubling thing.
Yeah, I think actually maybe the biggest implications will be the political implications for environmentalism. Right now, the big selling point for the Endangered Species Act is extinction is forever. But what if it isn't?
So optimistically, we can look forward to a world without men and full of woolly mammoths.
God creates dinosaurs. God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man. Man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs eat man. Woman inherits the earth.
Hank, thanks so much for joining us to talk about the year in genetics.
Been my pleasure. I hope we can do it again soon.
Hank Greeley from the Stanford Law School on the year in biology and genetics.
We invite you to continue examining the year that was, 2012, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is, cogito ergo blago, I think, therefore I blog. You can also follow our tweets on Twitter, and you can find out more by visiting our very active Facebook page.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2013.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
The program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Dave Millar, Jimmy Tobin, I Tran, Carola Kreitmar, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Templeton Foundation. And also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Lincoln, featuring a retractable roof on the 2013 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to 15 square feet of skylight. More at Lincoln.com.
From APM, American Public Media, and WNYC, this is Freakonomics Radio on Marketplace. Here's the host of Marketplace, Kai Ryssdal.
Time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio, that moment in the broadcast every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of everything. Dubner, how are you?
Kai, I'm great. Thank you.
Happy New Year and all that.
thank you to you as well. Today, yeah. Big news, the Baseball Hall of Fame voting was announced. Yeah. I don't know if you caught that.
Of course I did.
And a grand total of zero people were elected to the Hall of Fame this
year.
Now,
were you surprised?
I was a little bit surprised. It's the first time since 1996. In fact, you know, all the talk was about the fact that because the steroid age is happening now, and guys like Clemens and Bonds who deserve to be in but won't be elected because of...
Oh, wait a minute. Are we going to have that conversation? You think they deserve to be in? All right, that's a whole other
segment. No, I'm not having that conversation. That's another conversation. Right. But the argument was that because those guys are not going to get elected, that it would free up a little bit more space potentially. But as it turns out, nobody got in. And I got to tell you... This is what I'm here to talk about today. This is bad news. If you get nominated to a Hall of Fame and don't get in, not only do you not get in, but I hate to tell you this, Kai, you actually might die a little bit sooner.
Because why? What? Why?
Well, there's a growing body of research that looks at the relationship between what we call status generally and life expectancy. Okay, so the economist David Becker, he looked at Hall of Fame data, Baseball Hall of Fame, and he found that while a player who gets elected to the Hall of Fame doesn't necessarily outlive the average baseball player, he does live a couple years longer than a player who gets nominated for the Hall of Fame, but year after year gets rejected. Mm. Here's David Becker.
So this seems to suggest to us that it's really this story that getting close but not winning is what's really bad for health, which we think is potentially a really profound point about the nature of status competition more broadly in our society.
So actually, it's not an honor just to be nominated, right?
That's exactly right, which is appropriate to talk about since tomorrow is the nominations for the Academy Awards will be announced. And there's also an Oscar effect. Donald Redelmeyer, who's a medical professor at the University of Toronto, he has done research and now argues that Oscar winners outlive their peers. And here's his best guess as to why that is.
Once you really got an uncontestable measure of your own peer approval, all of the subsequent, nasty reviews or setbacks or rejections just do not seem nearly as aggravating. Yeah. They sort of roll off your back, and in turn, that makes you much more resilient.
Absolutely.
Now, Kai, let me say this. This longevity research is pretty complex. Some researchers are unpersuaded, but the more fields you look at, the more plausible it seems that a status boost is good for your health, and perhaps more convincingly, that getting close to the mountaintop but never quite reaching it, that's a real setback. The economist Andrew Oswald looked at this phenomenon among 50 years' worth of Nobel Prize winners.
All right.
We do find that if you're lucky enough to win the Nobel Prize, you can expect about 18 months more of life.
Well, okay, but hold on. I mean, that's great, 18 more months. But when you win the Nobel Prize, you get like $1 million. How do you know it's not just being rich makes you live longer?
Yeah, that's a good question. So that's one of the first problems that a researcher has in this kind of research, which is to isolate a particular effect, in this case status, and isolate that from other factors like money. So they use a mathematical model that will control for other differences. And in this case, Oswald found that the money was not a factor in the Nobel winner's longevity. It was, he says, the winning itself.
A nominee for the Nobel Prize looks virtually identical to someone who actually wins the Nobel Prize. The real difference is simply one of them gets the telephone call from Stockholm and the other doesn't.
Well, I will speak only for myself here, Dubner. I am not going to win a Nobel Prize or get into the Hall of Fame or win an Oscar, right?
Hold out hope. Never say never, Kai. Yeah, you're right. You know, most of us will. That's not going to happen. We did, therefore, go looking for something that might help anybody if they want to live a little bit longer. And you know what, Kai? We actually found something.
All right, hit me, brother. What do you got?
Annuities. So these are the things that people buy. It's this financial instrument you buy, and it pays off a set amount each year, but only as long as you stay alive. So it's like a longevity lotto, right? And research shows that people who buy annuities tend to live longer, and not just because they're the kind of people that have the money to buy annuities to start with. It's apparently that little extra incentive of the annuity payout that keeps people going. So, you know, maybe those Hall of Fame losers want to stock up on the annuities this week.
Any little bit helps, I guess. Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics.com is the website. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Thanks very much, Guy.
Wow.
web or home or in your car. Listen to WHFR, Dearborn.
The 5101 Restaurant is Henry Ford Community College's innovative on-campus dining experience. The restaurant is operated by students and staff of HFCC's Hospitality Studies program and offers a learning experience for the students combined with a delicious and affordable meal for you. The 5101 is open Tuesday through Thursday from 11:15 a.m. to 1 p.m. and Wednesday and Thursday evenings from 6 p.m. to 7:45. Reservations are suggested and can be made at 313-206-5101. That's 313-206-5101. See you soon at HFCC's 5101 Restaurant.
You are now listening to WHFR, 89.3 FM on your radio dial. I am the Diva, and my show, Lyrical Infusion, is on every Monday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. Join me as I serve up some mental musical gumbo for your moody Monday pleasure. You can always listen live to WHFR at www.whfr.fm 24/7.